This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. What if everything we thought we knew about politics was totally wrong? The people we see year after year on our TV screens and read about in the papers are just marionettes, puppets of a much higher power operating behind the scenes for centuries, even possibly since the dawn of time. Last week, though, we heard about the sad death of wartime MI6 agent and author of Operation James Bond, the book. He helped Hitler's treasurer escape at the end of World War II. His name, John Ainsworth Davis. This week, we conclude with famous TV personality talking about rumours of Hitler's treasurer's secret life in South America. And we go back to the ill-fated battle of Operation Market Garden in September 1944, hearing how Tory Foreign Secretary and Bilderberg Chairman Lord Carrington described his role in halting his tanks for a 17-hour break just when the British paratroopers at Arnhem needed him most. Plus, Germany on the rise, drones, nuclear subs, intelligence services and an army that's now able to operate all over the world. Is what's now Britain's Europe's strongest economy becoming a dangerous once again? But we start this week with a guest from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre. It's Will Stone. Hi, Will, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
First of all, Will, your specialism is to do with equality. I know that. And maybe we can just start by looking at some of the decisions that have been made this week. One particular one to do with people who have mental health problems. And they are obviously having to go through all sorts of things like these work capability assessments. I'm assuming this is the infamous ATOS assessments. What's been decided anyway this week? Maybe you can put me straight.
That's just about right, really. The Court of Appeal only 2 days ago handed down a judgment that effectively, it's quite a complex 27-page judgment, but to put in summary, it effectively said that the way the Department of Works and Pensions were approaching the employment support allowance medical assessments for people with mental health conditions and disabilities was discriminatory under the Equality Act, because they were failing to make reasonable adjustments basically to enable those claimants to attend interviews, to complete the forms and have the assessments done.
So, I mean, don't the government have their own lawyers? Why are they breaking the law?
Well, it's not a straightforward issue. This was to do with really the way, for example, some people felt very pressurised by having to attend interviews, had difficulties in completing the forms, and the Job Centre Plus, the Department of Works and Pensions, were doing nothing to assist them. That skewed the whole assessment, which meant that in some cases people were found to be fit for work when they clearly weren't fit for work. And I think we all know, because we've heard the media reports, that on at least one occasion that led to people feeling so stressed and anxious that they took their own lives.
I mean, this is obviously quite a serious business. I think it's probably fair to say that this kind of problem that faces people with mental illnesses, it doesn't just occur for these kind of benefit assessments. It's also things like getting housing. We're getting into a situation where there's less and less provision for these people, and it's almost like the law of the jungle. Everyone has to fight for it, and for mentally ill people, they're just simply not able to take on something as onerous as a court case or an appeal.
Well, that's right, and there are lots of issues around housing, as you said, particularly the home choice bidding scheme, where people have to make a certain number of bids, and they have to do it online, and they have to do it a certain number of times a week, and some people just find that a very stressful and a very difficult thing to do. They may not have a computer, they may have difficulties, they may feel very anxious about going to public places and doing this, doing it in an internet shop or in a library, and they may not want their personal information to be able to be accessed so easily in such a public space. And yet none of that is taken into account when people's points or their banding system on the housing register are relegated, or they're taken off the housing register altogether because they haven't been bidding, and then they're left in the unsuitable accommodation that they're in, which put them on the register in the first place. So it's very much a circular catch-22 situation.
So I'm hoping that our city council here don't just work by the laws of the jungle, and that there is some sort of assistance for people with mental illnesses to go through this process. Sounds pretty onerous and complicated to me.
It's something that needs to be raised with them. It's something that we're looking at raising with them.
Sounds like you're saying that they're not really helping people enough.
I think that what's happening is that a lot of these online-based schemes over the past, say, 5 to 10 years, these have been seen as being the way forward. Nobody's really looked behind to see what the difficulties are, and there's just an assumption that if it's digital, it's good, and that is something that you have to follow. And if you can't follow, the systems just aren't in place to help people who need support. They need to be guided towards, for example, given a support worker, or guided to organisations that can actually assist and help them do that, and that doesn't appear to be happening. It's happening in some cases, but it's not happening as a matter of course.
Now, 4 or 5 years ago, when I was a representative for the voluntary sector in Bristol on the Cultural Development Partnership and other things, I was asked to take part in a consultation with the City Council, and I mean, all of us, there were 5 or 6 people from around the city who all told the council, if you're going to change the way you're doing things, because the old system used to be, you put your name on a housing register, and all of those, then you get points, and then you were approached by the council. What they've done is they've taken the onus off themselves to fulfil their statutory duty to house people, and they've now said to those people who are some of the most vulnerable in society, well, sorry guys, we're putting a little system in place, but actually the onus is on you.
That's absolutely right. I think you've hit the nail on the head, and that is something that needs to be addressed. It can only be addressed on a case-by-case basis with the organisation that I work for, Raven and Bristol Law Centre. But we're interested in talking to people who are having problems, because we can raise it directly with Bristol City Council.
Also, there was an issue which hasn't really been covered extensively in the regional TV broadcasters, that kind of thing, which was a Bristol woman who killed herself after her benefits were stopped up in Kingswood. And she was in a retired nurse, and her name was Jacqueline Harris, and she'd been through a whole process of an ATOS assessment. What they've said, Will, is her family have said, is that she went for an ATOS assessment, she managed to get there, it took her several hours by bus, she was partially sighted, and she had to use sticks to walk. She was found it very difficult to walk, but when she actually made it to this work capability assessment, she didn't even have a chance to take off her coat, and she was told, okay, you're capable for work. Now, somebody in that sort of state clearly is not capable of work. She certainly can't compete with the million or so young people who are also looking for work. And then she's found the entire process of going through appeals impossible to do, and she's taken her own life. I mean, what can you say to encourage people to actually, you know, who are in that sort of situation, or maybe know someone who's in that situation, who's being basically asked to do the impossible? I mean, she cannot find a job, almost impossible for somebody like that, and yet she spent her whole life serving the public.
And another difficulty is that the legal aid help that was available for people to help people with social security appeals, these type of work assessment benefits appeals, that was taken away in April of this year. So there is no legal help available for those first tier, the straightforward appeals against a benefit decision. However, we've been at Avon and Bristol Law Centre, we've been training up students to assist people with these appeals. We've had a remarkably high success rate. We're talking about 85, 86 100% success rate. If somebody appeals against an employment and support allowance assessment and they get the proper help to put their appeal together, they get some further medical advice, for example, asking the correct questions of the doctors, then what we found is that the appeals have been successful and the tribunals have been overturning the decisions.
Well, the tragedy is that her first appeal, Jacqueline Harris's first appeal against that decision earlier this year, failed, but the second appeal was due to be heard by Her Majesty's Court Tribunal Service on the 15th of November. She didn't actually make it. The thing is here, Will, is that people do need to know where they can come, and you're saying that they may be able to get some advice from Avon Bristol Law Centre. You've got possibly students that can aid people in these appeals, and so many are successful. Sounds to me like what you're saying is if you feel that there's any kind of merit to your case, the best thing to do is appeal.
That's right. And we've got a team who can help people with those kind of appeals. We've also got a team who can help people raise issues around discrimination. If it's a matter of taking a discrimination case against the Job Centre Plus or against ATOS or against the Department of Works and Pensions, we can look into doing that.
The other aspect to all of this, of course, is that she's only asked this one question: did you come here by bus, by someone who wasn't a doctor? I mean, is that actually enforceable in law? Because you would have thought if somebody is legally assessing her ability to work or not, they should be a doctor.
The problem is if they're making the decision, then, and that decision has been made by the person who's been empowered to do it, then of course that is a lawful decision, and the only way it can be challenged is by way of an appeal to a Social Security Commission or an upper tribunal appeal, as it said. Now, legal aid will be available for that, but I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, what the Court of Appeal have said essentially is that people with mental health conditions, that the Department of Works and Pensions, the Job Centre, should be getting further medical advice on a whole range of symptoms if those symptoms have been notified to them.
So you're saying that also that if the government hadn't changed, this is Ken Clark originally got this whole thing moving, hadn't taken away so much of legal aid, Jacqueline Harris may have been entitled to some aid with her appeal.
She would have been entitled to some aid with her appeal. She would have been able to get legal aid help at the Law Centre or at a variety of other advice centres around Bristol.
Moving on then to looking at employment rights, because increasingly there's a lot of outsourcing going on. The big student protests that have been going on this week in London also include an element of that. We've had a lot of the workers, cleaners, this kind of things, janitors at the universities around the country being outsourced, and they have united with students from the National Union of Students who are having their actual student unions closed down. We've had something like 40 arrests yesterday, more arrests earlier in the week, as students try and have their right to peaceful protest, and then those protests are broken up violently by the police. This outsourcing business, what are your employment rights? Because they change, don't they? If the state is employing you, if the university is employing you, is one thing. But if they are then outsourcing that employment to another person, then you may be on one of these, for example, these zero-hour contracts, where your employment rights are massively less. So can you just take us through the different kinds of rights that there are at the moment?
Well, that shouldn't happen overnight. With any outsourcing, if it's going from the public sector into the private sector, then the transfer of undertakings regulations apply, and the contract that the employee has transfers over to the new employer, the private company. It should be a seamless matter, and you can't be dismissed because that transfer is about to take place, because it would be automatically unfair. Now, that's the theory. The practice is a little bit different, because once the transfer has taken place, then the new employer is allowed to look at their economic business model and to make changes, and to make changes to terms and conditions. Now, if the employee doesn't agree with those terms and conditions, then there could be a redundancy situation applicable, or they may find that they're in a position where they have to agree those new terms and conditions. So yes, once it's actually happened, then things can be changed for an economic or for a business reason. Now, it impacts more, perhaps, in a worse way, on new employees, because then the new company can take on new employees, offer them worse terms and conditions, perhaps 0 hours contracts. You end up then with this almost sort of two-tier employee situation, which isn't very good in any work situation, where one employee may be on a 0 hours contract and may be used from time to time, and there may be other employees who are still on their fixed 35-hour a week contracts, and the resentment that that can cause between employees doesn't really help to have a particularly cohesive workplace. It's not good.
Now, the some of these managers, I was chatting to one of the students earlier on, late yesterday, are on six-figure salaries, some of these managers, and they are in the situation where they're starting to hire and fire. Basically, if there is union organising going on in universities in the future, this is what the students are telling me, that they're quite clear that people will be much more easily sacked. Is that true or not?
Well, you shouldn't sack somebody for carrying out trade union activities. That's
shouldn't, but can you?
When I mean you say you shouldn't, it's unlawful as well, and it's automatically unfair. Now, at the moment, you can only take an unfair dismissal claim if you've been employed for 2 years. However, that doesn't apply if you're dismissed for an automatically unfair reason, and one of those automatically unfair reasons at the moment is that you have been dismissed for undertaking trade union activities. Of course, again, that's the theory. In the practice, what the employer would probably do is to find some other reason to dismiss you. They may issue you with new terms and conditions. They may look at capability issues. They may impose targets and start looking at targets issues. They may create a stressful working environment from you where you have no option other than to go off sick, and then you find yourself in a position where, because you're unlikely to return to work simply because you can't face it, you find yourself dismissed.
Well, I was chatting to a former BBC producer a few years ago, and she was saying how she was moved out of the main production office down into basically like a little basement boiler room with a telephone, where the actual keypad on the telephone had a couple of the keys that didn't work, and she was basically being bullied. Now, isn't this what employers do? Is if they don't like you, they don't like the look of you, they put you in a box marked trouble, and then you're going to be targeted one way or another right into the future.
Bullying and harassment is a very difficult claim to take, because there's no claim that you can take to an employment tribunal saying my employer is bullying and harassing me. What you have to do is use the grievance procedure, and if that doesn't work, and if the bullying and harassment continues and the employer doesn't stop it, then you find yourself with no alternative but to consider resignation and taking a rather more complex claim called constructive dismissal, which is a breach of contract claim. You're saying that your employer has breached your contract of employment. It's the most difficult claim to take. It's the most difficult claim to win, and we advise a lot of people on our employment advice lines and at our employment sessions, and it's a very difficult thing to do, and a very rare situation where you find yourself saying to an employee, look, you're going to have to resign, you've got to throw away your entire career if you want to progress this thing through the courts. You can't do it. It's a very difficult thing to do. Of course, if somebody's already done that, if somebody said, well, I resigned because I couldn't stand it anymore, then they're in a much stronger position.
There's been quite a lot of stories recently also, and questions raised in Parliament about the whole business of sacking pregnant women, because in the old days you used to get help with taking your employer to a tribunal in that case. What's the situation now?
Well, at Avon and Bristol Law Centre, we can still help people do that, because we get funding from Bristol City Council to run discrimination claims and to advise people on discrimination issues. But the story that I always tell on this is several years ago, a case that I took to the Bristol Employment Tribunal, where the manager of the HR department of the company that we were claiming rang me up and said, you don't believe that in this day and age we would seriously have dismissed your client simply because she was pregnant, would she? I said, well, you know, that's not for me to say now, or for us to have this discussion. That's for the tribunal to decide tomorrow. We went to the tribunal. The tribunal reached the unanimous conclusion that there was no other reason for her dismissal other than the fact that she had said that she was pregnant. So it does happen. It seems to happen more and more we found that we're getting a lot more inquiries from women who have notified their employers that they're pregnant, and they find that they're being treated differently and unfavorably from the other employees. That may be that they're made redundant, it may be that they're just find that the way that they're treated is different. Again, the use of target-based capability procedures sometimes is used as a way of kind of getting people out of the job. It does happen.
Now, the fact that Ken Clark, the coalition government, have taken away a lot of legal aid for these kinds of employment tribunal cases, is there any point in people coming to see you, Will?
Well, there is, because I mean, we can advise people ways in which they can perhaps resolve the matter without considering taking a claim. The other issue with taking a claim now, of course, this year, for the first time ever, we've had the introduction of tribunal fees. And if you wanted to take a discrimination claim, for example, against an employer, you'd be facing a fee of £1,200 with no guarantee that you would get that back even if you won. Now, most people don't have £1,200 in their back pocket to take their employer to tribunal, as well as the stress of doing that. But if you can get some advice very early in the proceedings, there may be ways, by using the grievance procedures, by raising things in a proper sense that shows that you have had legal advice and you know what you're talking about, that the matter can be resolved.
Now, that's a lot of money to pay. Surely that's not justice. You know, if you're saying that you have to pay for justice, and you're in a situation where you don't have that £1,500, you don't have any justice.
Well, the employers put a lot of lobbying onto the government on this one, and that what they wanted was the fees in order to deter people from taking claims. What we've heard from the local tribunal, the Bristol Employment Tribunal, is in fact since July, since the fee system was put in, a lot of people have been deterred from taking claims. The number of claims that have been taken out have gone down.
Sounds to me like you're saying no, there isn't justice, Will, but you probably wouldn't say that, would you?
There is justice if you can get it.
Okay. Anyway, so if you could just tell us whereabouts people can find you. Will, I know you're down at the bottom of Stokes Croft, aren't you?
We're at the bottom of Stokes Croft, 2 Moon Street. Our telephone number for our reception is 0117 924 8662. And you can also look at our website, which is www.ablc.org.uk, and all the details of how you can contact us there. If you've got an issue with employment, if you've got an issue with your benefits, or if you've got an issue with the fact that you think you're being discriminated against.
Okay, Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now, Martin Summers, our little tour of the world's hotspots. Let's start with Ukraine, because this country seems to be being torn apart from within. It can't decide whether it wants to ally itself with the two big powers in Europe, one to the east, the Russians, and one to the west, the EU.
Well, I mean, I think I would say that that's the bones of the issue. You've got a lot of pressure on Ukraine because it's of a geopolitical position right in the middle of Europe there. And I hope they can resolve this satisfactorily, because, of course, the danger is that this is the fracture through which conflict could erupt if we're not careful.
Okay, so we've got Marina Morris here, who's herself Ukrainian, with a little report, at least helping to explain in part what's been going on over there. Marina.
There is a tug of war between the European Union and Russia. For the last 12 days, Ukrainians have been protesting because the Ukrainian government delegation refused to sign the agreement about a proposed association with the European Union at the summit in Vilnius. The country is deeply divided into two main camps. Protesters, and now more than 50% of the population, support closer ties and a strategic future with the European Union, not ties with a Russia trade federation. They believe their long-term interests are better than the real democracy as a part of Europe. Protest leaders are demanding the resignation of Ukrainian president and parliament. In contrast, the government and supporters of a Russia alliance believe that European Union has not offered the country a good deal, and that signing the deal will cause a financial catastrophe and possible collapse of the Ukrainian economy. Why join a European club in a crisis of its own? My family from eastern Ukraine are also divided. The younger generation see Russia as a domineering prospective partner, looking out for its own national interest. The older generation see a big crisis and unemployment in Europe and think similar things about the European Union. Ukraine would be the largest country in the European Union if it joined it. This vast natural resources and intellectual workforce. It also has a strategic geopolitical location and great potential for development.
Thanks very much, Marina. Well, I mean, it seems to me like a bit of fallout still echoing from perestroika and from the breakup of the Soviet Union, Martin. One of the most interesting things about Marina's saying there is that a lot of the younger generation want to go with the European side. A lot of the older generation seem allied with the Russians. Viktor Yanukovych, who's Ukraine's president, seems to be trying to make deals with the Russians, whilst most of the population, at least according to Marina and those polls, are actually pro-EU.
Well, I think that it's divided. I think Marina's probably right that the majority at the moment want to be part of the EU. I think the problem is that the Russians have a fairly tempestuous relationship with the EU and NATO. If the relationship between Russia and NATO and the EU was better, Ukraine would be in a better position because there wouldn't be a row going on. Both sides, I mean, don't forget that NATO is planning to put short-range missiles into Poland and Kaliningrad and so on, which the Russians regard as threatening. So from a military point of view, the Russian military are looking at Ukraine joining the EU and thinking, oh, that's coming right up close to our door.
I mean, but wouldn't the Russians themselves also put military in Ukraine if the alliance was with the Russians?
Well, exactly. The point is that this could militarise. At the moment, this is a political dispute. There are protesters in the streets and so on. But this could end up as a military confrontation. This is what's underlying all of this. Incidentally, by the way, I would put it to politicians in this country. We're now getting upset about the Bulgarians and the Romanians coming here. As Marina pointed out, if Ukraine joined the EU, it would be the biggest country in the EU. What is the population of Ukraine, Marina?
57 million.
57 million. Now, I think what the Ukrainians need to grasp is that in Britain, we're not happy about, many people are not happy about the existing size of the EU. And lots of UKIP people would say, well, why do you want to join the EU? But of course, they haven't had the history that Ukraine's had. Ukrainians see the EU as a beacon of stability and freedom in a dangerous world.
Now, we had,
but of course, many people in Britain don't see the EU like that at all.
We had back in 2004 the so-called Orange Revolution with Yulia Tymoshenko, and then moving over to becoming actually much more friendly with the European Union. It seems that things are going the other way. Yulia Tymoshenko spent a lot of time in jail as well, didn't she? And I think that may be one of the reasons why people are out on the streets, because they feel hard done by that their political leader was jailed by this Viktor Yanukovych, the friend of Putin.
Well, that's right. And most post-Soviet politicians are not entirely uncorrupt. And that would be true of the whole political class, I would suggest, in countries like Ukraine, and I'm not excusing Britain from this either. The real problem is that whatever the Ukrainian people want, the Russian state has got its national interests, and they are very worried because when the Berlin Wall came down, Gorbachev was promised by Helmut Kohl and by the Americans and by the British that NATO would not be expanded if he allowed a united Germany. And the Russians, against their better judgment, allowed a united Germany strictly on the understanding that NATO would not be expanded. Now, what then happened is countries like Poland and others agitated to join NATO. NATO agreed for them to join, but the Russians felt very let down by that because, hang on, the deal was that they wouldn't join NATO. Now, you say, well, it's harmless for people to join NATO. Well, then the Russians said, well, if everybody's joining NATO, we'll join NATO. I said, oh, no, you can't. Now, of course, the perception by the Russians of that is, so everybody else is joining NATO, which is actually a hostile alliance to us because we're not allowed to join it. This is a potential. Don't forget that Russia has been invaded from the West several times. in the 20th century. There was intervention by the West in the Russian Civil War in the 1920s, and it was invaded in 1942, and an enormous lot of people died. So you can understand why there is fear in the Russian establishment about the intentions of the West. We're not necessarily regarded by the Russians as entirely reliable partners.
Well,
and it's not surprising.
Did the Russians invade into Eastern Europe during the 1950s, for example?
Well, no, they invaded in the 1940s, driving the Germans back into Germany. But it was the Germans who crossed
I'm talking about interventions in Eastern Europe.
Well, they did. What happened?
In
the 50s, they intervened, indeed, in their own sphere of influence, just as the British intervened in the Greek Civil War in the 1940s to crush the communists, and the Russians turned a blind eye. Now, in other words, a dirty deal was done, what Churchill called my naughty document, where basically Stalin was allowed to have Poland as long as he didn't interfere in Greece and places like that. So a sphere of influence was then drawn up. Now, this kind of 19th century power politics in many ways seems ridiculous in the 21st century. But on the other hand, it's still very much there. I mean, why are NATO insisting on putting short-range missiles into Eastern European NATO countries? That's absolutely provocative to the Russians. And the Russians are saying, why are you doing this? You're putting your missiles in our face. And so it's not to protect against you, it's to protect against the Iranians. And Putin at one of these summits said, well, hang on a minute, if we're protecting against the Iranians, you can put your missiles in Azerbaijan and point them directly at Iran. So no, we want them in Poland to protect the West from the Iranians. Now, no serious Russian general takes that seriously, nor do the Russian population. Those missiles are directed at Russia. Now, if Ukraine wants to join the EU, and I'm not necessarily opposed to it, although many other people in the EU won't be happy about it, UKIP and the right wing of the Conservative Party, they don't want Ukraine to join the European Union. They don't want all these people coming here. You can be sure of that. But if we don't kind of get a better relationship with Russia, the easiest and simplest way to get a better relationship with Russia, straightforward, is don't put short-range missiles in Eastern Europe to threaten them. Why are we doing that? Now, if we stopped doing that, the Russians would calm down a bit, and then we could talk in a more rational way about what should happen with Ukraine. But if the Western powers want to push the Russians inevitably are going to react to that. And one of the ways they've leaned very heavily on Yanukovych that he mustn't sign this deal. And it's been spelled out that if you do sign the deal, it won't be a nice joining of the EU where your living standards go up. We are going to cut off your gas supply. We are going to blockade your... We're going to make life difficult for you if you make life difficult for us by joining the EU. I would suggest that Ukraine's politics could be squared up if everybody recognises that Ukraine needs to be independent of both blocs and friendly with everybody. That's what I would see the future for Ukraine. There's no reason why they can't have an association agreement with the EU and a deal with the Russians, and they could actually be a bridge instead of being a problem.
And Marina there is nodding away. Okay, thanks very much, Martin.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, last week we heard about the sad death of wartime MI6 agent and the author of OpJB, Operation James Bond, John Ainsworth Davis. During the war, he helped Hitler's treasurer escape at the end of World War II. And this week, a famous TV personality gives his views about rumours of Hitler's treasurer, Martin Bormann, and his secret life in South America.
Yes, well known. Many people know that their telephones are tapped. And sometimes you can even get the tapes from the police if you pay for them. For instance, if you want to follow someone, a friend or your wife or something like that, and then you can get your own telephone tapped and then pay for the tapes.
But what about your telephone, Father? Do you think that's tapped?
It is, definitely. Definitely, we were told, yes.
As political refugees or seeking work, some 600,000 Paraguayans have left the country. That's a quarter of the population. Movement in the other direction, into the posher parts of Paraguay, is said to have included Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann, Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller, and the doctor at the Auschwitz concentration camp, a Bavarian called Josef Mengele, who's taken Paraguayan nationality. Inquiries about these retiring residents are not welcomed.
Well, they may not there, but they certainly are here. We've been looking into this quite a lot, haven't we, over the last couple of weeks, Martin? It sounds like a whole menagerie of former Nazis over in South America. Why was it you think that so many of them headed there? I mean, I know that the regime was actually pro-Nazi, wasn't it, during the Second World War?
Well, I think the Nazi regime had done a lot of work in the 30s to build up relations with the right wing in Latin America.
Yeah, but in Spain too, of course.
And in Spain too, of course. Frankly, a lot of people went via Spain. And the rat lines that were used, there were suggestions that the Vatican was also involved, particularly with the Croatians who were Catholics. And Latin America seemed like a good place for these type of people to go. And don't forget, of course, the US had a fairly big influence in Latin America. And somebody like Klaus Barbie, who we mentioned last week, who was the head of Gestapo in Lyon, tortured many French resistance people to death. He was spirited away to Latin America by these rat lines and eventually employed by the CIA to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. Eventually, he was extradited back to France and stood trial and so on. But I think it's fairly common knowledge now that elements within the Nazi intelligence structure, particularly the very senior people who knew a lot and had a lot of information and contacts, they were basically integrated into the NATO intelligence structure as it was being formed at the end of the war, as the OSS became the CIA and so on.
But also at the end of the war,
Operation Paperclip, if people look that up online, they will see that the information about this is overwhelming. The question is everybody knows about Wernher von Braun and the rocket scientists, but a lot of the intelligence operatives and torturers were integrated into the Western intelligence structure, which then went on to found the Gladio structures, which were involved in terrorism in Western Europe in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And they were using fascist techniques because they were fascists.
Well, just rewinding slightly back to the end of the war there, and we've discussed quite a few times on here this Operation Market Garden and the role in it of some of the senior British commanders, the troops bravely fighting on, the British 1st Airborne Division at Arnhem, and Lord Carrington, that was later become a foreign secretary under Margaret Thatcher, and the chairman of the Bilderberg conferences, was there. He was actually in that battle. There's a mysterious gap, 17 hours. If the tanks commanded by Carrington, his little tank troop, and the Guards Armoured Division above them had carried on, many people say, including Tony Hibbert, who was there, he was the last man in command of the force at Arnhem Bridge, said that the war could have ended by Christmas.
Well, yes, Tony. I mean, you've done a lot of research into this and you've interviewed many of the people in the Battle of Arnhem, and I understand a lot of the discussion is on the Army Rumour Service website of those who fought in the battle. The suggestion is that the battle was thrown because a deal had been done behind the scenes with people like Bormann, and they needed time for that deal to come to fruition, which is why the war couldn't end too quickly.
Now, this was all discussed by the BBC in their excellent Battlefields series. Martin Bormann had this, Moffat Burris, not Martin Bormann, no, yep. Moffat Burris, who's the US 82nd Airborne Division commander who took the Nijmegen Bridge. When Lord Carrington rumbled over on the night of the 20th of September 1944 in the early evening, he was expecting that whole troop and the tanks to rumble onto Arnhem and actually save the day, because there was still an hour and a half or so, maybe a couple of hours, before the Arnhem troops finished. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to T. Moffat Burris, the American, who tried to persuade Lord Carrington to carry on that evening to Arnhem and save the day.
I thought they were going to blow the bridge up at any moment, and I imagine so did he. And I was absolutely astonished when we got over the bridge.
We just swarmed over the tank and started hugging the guys. I remember the guy's head that was sticking out of the turret, I just hugged him around the neck and I said, "You guys are the greatest sight I've seen in years." And I kissed the tank and told them to head on to Arnhem. And I said, "Why are you stopping? Why are you not going to Arnhem?" He said, "Well, I can't go up there. That gun will knock out my tank." And I said, "Well, we'll go with you and get that gun." And he said, "No, I can't go without orders."
The road from the bridge was on a sort of embankment, and I think it would have been quite difficult to go ahead. I think it would have been difficult anyway, even in the daylight, because you were a sitting duck for anybody who was there. But I thought at night, when we'd just sort of stormed the bridge, so to speak, it would have been very difficult to push through in the dark.
Well, I felt betrayed. I just sacrificed half of my company to capture that bridge, and in the face of dozens of guns, and they were stopping because of one gun, and they had a whole corps of tanks.
Well, there he is. He's saying they've got a corps of tanks. Why didn't they move on? But that is a question which will probably other historians will look at. But Martin, is it possible that that there was a that they actually threw that battle in order to give the Nazis more time?
Well, we've got listen, but we are investigating this, as you know. You've interviewed Moffat Burrows. You've interviewed many of the people who were involved, including Tony Hibbert, the British commander at Arnhem.
I mean, as Moffat Burrows says, they had a corps of tanks. I mean, I'm not saying every single tank was available.
No,
of course not.
Now, people might think, why are we muddling around with all of this? Let's try and put it in perspective. The suggestion is that John Ainsworth Davis, who had contacts with the Nazi high command, including Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's second-in-command and very much the fixer for the regime, and that a deal was being done behind the scenes, and John Ainsworth Davis said all of this in his book, Operation James Bond, and the name James Bond came from the operation, not from the books that were later written by Ian Fleming, who was also involved in the operation. Deals were being done before the end of the war with elements within the Nazi intelligence structure, including Martin Bormann, including Reinhard Gehlen and others, that the war, that everybody knew that the war, the next war was being prepared for, which was against the Soviet Union. And the elements within the Nazi structure, Gehlen, for example, said to the Americans, I've got loads of agents inside the Soviet Union. Do you want those agents? Because if you do, you better be nice to me. And the Americans said, yep, we want those agents. And Gehlen ends up as the head of the BND, the West German Intelligence Service. So the suggestion is that a deal was done for Bormann to be rescued from Berlin, for all of the money that the Nazis had accumulated as loot to be passed into the hands of the Western Intelligence Services, and for all of this to happen, the war couldn't end too quickly, and therefore Arnhem had to be lost, so that the war dragged on a little bit longer so all of this could be finalised. And of course the Bilderberg Group meets in 1954 Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands in the chair, who was actually forced on the Market Garden planners by King George VI and those close to him, including
and he was
Morton,
a former SS officer?
Former SS officer, so that we can start to see the whole deal beginning to develop, and the suspicion is that the battle was thrown so that the deal could be done. And I think that we've got soldiers who are on the ground who have that suspicion.
Fascinating. Anyway, it does make you wonder, doesn't it? If does everything we know about history, military, and politics completely wrong? Anyway, so let's have a listen now to the man who predicted 9/11, William Cooper, Bill Cooper, and his take on politics. He believes the whole thing is actually run by a bunch of people he calls the priesthood from behind the scenes.
A bolt of lightning struck a tree. The tree burst into flames. Ancient man, if you watch the movie Quest for Fire, rushed up and grabbed one of the burning branches, and it burned his hand, and he let it go. He probably didn't go any farther than that the first time. Second time, he may have found a deer that had been roasted by the heat of the fire in the forest, and being hungry, maybe he partook of some of that meat and found that it tasted pretty good. Also, the fire was warm and didn't get cold at night. And this is where the whole battle between the forces of light and darkness comes from. Man sat up on a rock one night watching the sunset and said, boy, I'm in deep trouble now. I can't see in the dark. There's wild beasts out there. There's tigers with teeth 7 inches long that want me for dinner. What am I going to do? He didn't know what to do. Neither would many of us put in that situation. But we would know one thing, we're in deep trouble. And so for a good part of his history, man sat huddled in the darkness in some place that made him feel secure, waiting to be saved. Now remember, folks, I'm not telling you what I believe. I'm telling you what is taught in the mysteries. I'm telling you what our enemies believe. Make no mistake about it, they are our mortal enemies. They want to see us wiped off the face of the earth. A man huddled in this darkness, fearful, trembling, cold, hungry. and around about he could hear the beasts roaring, and sometimes they were roaring because they were after him, and sometimes he was eaten. A man eventually saw another tree struck by lightning and grabbed that branch with that flame on it, and by a little experimentation he learned how to keep that fire going. And if he could keep the fire going, he knew something nobody else knew, and he became the first king, the first priest, the first scientist, all rolled into one. And he would burn this fire and keep it going. Another man in the cold of the night, wanting to escape from the terrors that were out there, would gravitate toward this glow, and they would see this man sitting there. And if he was kind, he would let them come to the fire, and they would be warm, and they would be protected, because if the wild beast came, he'd pick up a branch and shove it in its face, and the beast would go away. And so the forces of light overcame the forces of darkness, and in the sunshine of the morning, the newly risen, resurrected child that had died the night before, their Savior, warmed them and saved them from the terrors of the Prince of Darkness. You have to study these things to understand your enemy. Any general who ventures upon a battlefield without understanding the enemy is doomed to defeat. Just like a militia that forms itself upon a peninsula has already created its own concentration camp, unless it has a navy. What is the upshot of this? What am I getting at here? These people believe, and they have conducted themselves according to their belief and their philosophy, since the very dawn of man. These people learned how to control others through the use of a hidden knowledge. This ability to keep that fire going was a technology that nobody else knew. By observing the fire, by keeping it going, by creating ceremonies around this fire, they became a mystery to the others. A mystery always holds sway over those who don't understand it. And the priesthood was born. No king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. And I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power, and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be of benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way. The king is dead, long live the king, and there would be another king appointed. There was even a time in history when the king was a sacrificial king, just like John F. Kennedy was in the Temple of the Sun known as Dealey Plaza. They would pick a young man with the height of his virility, appoint him king for 1 year. During that time, he could do or say or command whatever he wanted. The priesthood was always there to make sure he commanded the right things, have any woman that he wanted, and at the end of the year, he was ceremoniously sacrificed upon a rock, his heart ripped out, his body dismembered into 14 pieces and scattered over the land. And this is where the legend of the Osirian cycle began. It was to ensure the fertility of the crops of the next year. And young men would volunteer for this in their patriotic duty to their kingdom, to their family, so that they could have prosperous years. Much as our young men may volunteer to rush out over the water to a place called Kuwait or Iraq and die in the godforsaken sands of a place that nobody can even find on a map and never heard of until it happened, all so that he can be called a patriot, someone his family can be proud of. It escapes me how they can ever arrive at these conclusions, but they do, and the priesthood always takes the most advantage of this willingness to sacrifice oneself upon the altar of his country. The problem with it is, it's very seldom really for the country. It's for the advancement of the agenda of the priesthood, whoever the priests happen to be at the time. Am I attacking the church? You better believe it. All churches, all organized religions that have existed since the beginning of the time. Am I attacking the religion of individuals? Never, not on your life. He wasn't trying to create a big church. He knew what happened to those things. And you're all wrong about that man when you say he shouldn't get angry. You shouldn't curse. You shouldn't do things that upset other people, because that's what Jesus spent his whole life doing. He threw the money changers out of the temple. Don't you think that made some people angry? Don't you think it was rude to walk up to somebody's place of business, smack them in the mouth, grab their table, and throw it out the door? What about the time he cursed the fig tree? You know, pious Christians sometimes make me very angry. They don't even know Christianity. They don't know the man they're following. He was a revolutionary. He was a dangerous man. And by God, so am I. And so should you be. This country was founded by dangerous men. And the moment the people in this country cease to be dangerous men, it's going to be the day we cease to have a country. Their whole goal with this philosophy is to teach all men and women that the only end of life is to seek the utmost pleasure and happiness that you can get out of it, because when you die, there's nothing else. That's what they teach. That's what they want you to be. They don't want laws against sexual promiscuity. That's why they don't want families. That's why they don't want marriage. That's why they encourage homosexuality. There's a method to their madness. There's really not much method to yours, because you're operating from a place of ignorance. And until you change that, you're going to be bumbling around, bumping into each other, saying and doing the wrong things, not understanding the nature of your enemy. And if you don't understand the nature of your enemy and the weapons they use, you cannot fight that enemy. You can't fight the battle. You shouldn't even be on the battlefield. That's why you're losing the war. Don't tell me you're not, because I'm in a place of great knowledge about who's winning and who's losing this war. And I can assure you, you're losing the war. Doesn't mean it can't be turned around. But it'll never be turned around until you learn what you need to know. You don't even recognize half the weapons that they use against you. And some of them seem so insignificant that you don't even try. They want to create a world where everybody is happy all the time, doing all of the things that, if you're from a good religious upbringing, is wrong to do. If you're not from a religious upbringing, but you have a good brain and you understand the purpose of morals and ethics, it's still the wrong thing to do. If you're a thinking person. And then the priests had an army. Oh boy, weren't they happy with that? whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated, with the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries. The very highest degrees of which, combined together, make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system. Now, do you think they're succeeding?
That was former U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer William Cooper there. Thanks very much to the guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Lawrence Hill, Hibak Jama, and to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Join us next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the life of Nelson Mandela is